House Committee on Group Business and Labor for the 15th of September, 2014. Okay, welcome all back. Doesn't seem like very long that we've been here, but before we get going, we have a couple of announcements about protocols and some different things that are going on in committees that people need to know. So, Jan?
Committee members, I want to let you know you have before you a background brief. This one happens to be on workers' compensation. Our office produces about 90 background briefs, and every 2 years we add to the list and update the ones that are there. This is an example. I think every meeting you go to during Ledge Days, you'll get a different one for your committee just to let you know what is out there, and we encourage you to go to the website to find the other 90 titles. And the other new thing is there's a new sound system recording program in the Capitol. It's called Granicus. There's no more flashing blue light when the committee is in recess. It's either on or it's off, and there's usually a 10-second delay for the time she says to start it up for the microphones to go live. But don't look for the flashing blue anymore.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Never paid attention to flashing blue anyway.
No.
Representative Chief, you did not. So, anyway, okay. We've got a few little changes on the agenda, but just changes in order. The first, we're going to hear the task force procuring through small and local businesses. Second thing would be an update on the workers' comp self-insure employer group legislation. Third is conforming work share programs with federal regulations. Fourth, the introduction of the new executive director of the Oregon Arts Commission and Cultural Trust. And then lastly, the report on the Office of Small Business. Okay. Thank you very much. So, Representative Gumbert and Representative Thatcher.
And Summer Warner.
And just as a reminder that you all need to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Representative David Gomberg from House District 10, presenting this morning on the task force on procuring through small and local business. And with me today, Representative Thatcher, who served on the committee, and Ms. Summer Warner, who is the project coordinator from DASC, who did most of the work on our behalf. So our task force met seven times during June and July this year to work on this project. We compiled a 43-page report, which I'll be happy to read for you slowly and in detail this morning, or I can just simply give you the executive summary.
Yeah, it is also on OLIS.
That's correct. The report is on OLIS.
I'd like just to hear him read it.
Well, I'll give you the summary first, Representative, and then we can go into the details.
Thank you.
The Task Force on Procuring Through Small and Local Business was created by House Bill 2667 in 2013 with the directive of studying public contract awards to minority-owned, women-owned, or emerging small businesses in the state of Oregon. More specifically, we were asked to examine the extent to which state agencies award public contracts to targeted firms, evaluate the extent to which large procurements could be feasibly broken down into smaller procurements, and to recommend incentives that can help to induce agencies to award public contracts. And finally, we were asked to report the results of our study to the legislature. The task force held weekly hearings and heard presentations from state and local government, from nonprofit assistance programs, from targeted firms, and all of them provided pertinent information on state contracting. The theme emerged consistently that for a variety of reasons, many eligible firms choose not to certify with the state. Because they do this because of the perceived difficulty of the application process and because of the perception that there's no assurance that certification will actually lead to contracts. Firms are simply choosing not to certify, and the state is missing the opportunity to partner with these businesses. Additionally, we're seeing that there are a number of eligible firms that are not certified but who do receive state contracts. And because the state relies on certification to validate and to track procurement with Oregon's targeted firms, we're unable to track those contracts, and therefore we're understating the state's progress in accomplishing our goals. So what are the reasons that many of these eligible firms are choosing not to to certify and to do business with the state? The first one that came up is that the application process is long and detailed. The application requires a lot of personal information, which some firms are hesitant to provide to the state. There's no assurance that they'll actually get contracts. Many businesses say they get the contracts without bothering with certification. We heard from companies that cited the time lag in getting paid when they do work with the state. And finally, we heard companies talk about their limited access to capital, which then limited their opportunity to pursue these contracts. Overall, it appears that the number of firms that are certified and the number of dollars going to those firms is declining. Now, keep in mind, as we said, that a number of firms are getting contracts and not being part of the process. But the contracts that we're reporting are declining, and the number of dollars that they affect are declining. The exception to that is in the African-American community, where the number of contracts and dollars is increasing. And through this community, we saw a positive example of how progress can be made. We learned that construction firms are being sufficiently supported, although there's always room for improvement, but that non-construction companies offering goods and services need more attention. And currently, there's no formal way to involve, include, and to reach out to non-construction firms. Finally, it appears that the state is awarding contracts to a narrower number of certified firms. That is to say that fewer firms are getting a lot of contracts. The goal should be to reach out to more companies, diversify the number of companies qualifying for state contracts, and to broaden the number of companies qualifying for this program. So, in summary, what we found is that we found that the number of firms qualifying is declining, the number of dollars going to those firms is declining, and in some cases the contracts are being concentrated amongst a fewer number of companies. And we found, not insignificantly, that that there were a number of firms that were not completing the application process. In fact, 25% of the companies that start the certification process fail to complete it. So the task force goal was to develop strategies on how to increase the number of certified firms. And while there are many state and community programs that support these companies in starting and growing their businesses, it seems that there could be a better connection with those programs and the education and benefits of being state certified. With these observations and through multiple presentations and data review, it became clear that there is great opportunity to increase certification with Oregon's eligible companies and to nurture the growth of firms already certified with the state. The task force, along with many key contributors and interested parties, developed multiple recommendations to help overcome barriers and to support the success of targeted companies. I wanted to highlight just a couple of those recommendations. First of all, we thought it important to follow up to businesses who failed to complete the registration and to encourage them to go through the certification process. As I said, our research details that 25% of the firms that start the process don't complete it. Secondly, we thought it worthwhile to create a direct referral system from the Secretary of State's Central Business Registry as part of the online business registration process. What we're talking about is that when new companies register with the state, either through incorporating or an assumed business name, that in that one-stop process that the Secretary of State has offered, we could put a checkbox or fill in the blank where companies can say, I want more information on how to get state contracts, and use that as an opportunity to reach out and to support companies and then lead them through the certification process. We talked about bundling smaller procurements and breaking down larger procurements so the potential contracts are more manageable by small companies. We suggested updating agency vendor quote requirements to follow best practices from other public entities regarding inclusion of quotes from certified firms. In other words, take examples that are working and show those examples in subject areas that aren't working as well and use those positive examples to include more companies and to make sure they're certified. We talked about creating a program to serve as a dedicated, centralized resource to grow the number of Oregon-certified businesses, build capacity, and assist in assessing state and local government opportunities. In other words, why don't we get a centralized source that's going to handle all of this rather than relying on a number of different agencies and offices in different subject areas? We talked about creating a program with the primary purpose of connecting and counseling businesses and state agencies through contracting. We talked about implementing an auditing team to review agency programs. We talked about reestablishing a quarterly meetings between these agencies and the small business development centers. In the past, there were quarterly meetings, and that was discontinued, and we thought that it would be good to continue to network once again with the small business development centers. And finally, we talked about researching the feasibility of implementing an insurance vendor contractor program for the state of Oregon. The full report provides a lot of details on each of these options and a lot of other ideas that we have, including the challenges business face in contracting with the state. It includes our thoughts and recommendations about how to increase certification, support, and assist minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses. Now, I wanted to digress for just a minute, because very often during our conversations with these targeted firms, we also talked about veterans enterprises. Now, veterans enterprises were outside the scope of the task force as detailed by the legislation that created us. But we did talk about the opportunity to work with veterans firms and to include them as emerging small businesses if they were interested in that. And we also talked about the fact that it might be worthwhile to create a future task force through legislation to do the same kind of work that we did for women-owned, minority-owned, and emerging small businesses, and focus on veterans. After reviewing the data and hearing from passionate vendors and partners in the state, the task force feels there's great need for increased focus and work to be done to nurture the state's relationships with minority-owned, women-owned, and emerging small businesses. I just wanted to add in conclusion that it was a real pleasure to chair this task force, that I appreciated the work of Representative Thatcher, and particularly wanted to thank Ms. Summer for the effort she put together in compiling all of this information. And I also want to thank the individuals, the businesses, the state agencies, and the nonprofits who all contributed their time and talent to the effort. That's a quick overview, Madam Chair. The 43-page document is on OLIS, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate you guys putting in the time. Very, very good results. Any questions, comments of the panel? Representative Thatcher, would you like to add some things to the presentation?
Madam Chair, I would love to if I needed to, but I think you covered it all, so we'll just leave it at that.
No, as I said, because I think that this was actually when it came together was your concept and your idea to go through and see how can we work with smaller businesses with regulations. And
well, it was Representative Frederick's bill that actually passed.
So, anyway, thank you all very much.
A good review.
Representative Holvey.
Thanks. In that 43 pages, does it break out, the number of contracts, not just as a group of small minority women-owned, but the small versus minority versus women, so that we can see which groups are succeeding and which ones aren't?
I promised Ms. Summer she'd get an opportunity to speak to the committee this morning. It seems like a great time to pass her the microphone.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, there is a breakdown actually on page 9.
If you could identify yourself for the record,
I'm sorry.
Please.
For the record, my name is Summer Warner. I am a project coordinator with the Department of Administrative Services. And yes, to answer your question, there is a breakdown of the number of firms by ethnicity and gender in the report. Does that answer? Yeah.
And also ones that are just small. Is there a definition of just small companies as well?
There is a definition of small, and I'm caught off guard. Yes, on page 10, does talk about the definition of the small businesses through Business Oregon.
And one clarification, this is Representative Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
One clarification, there can be categories that overlap, too. Like a person can be a minority-owned and women-owned business at the same time, but it would count in both columns.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
I know what page to look for. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you all very much for the work. It looks like a great report, and we look forward, if we have not already, of reading it from page to page.
Please do, Madam Chair. Thank you so much to the committee, and I'll be seeing several of you again when we report to another committee tomorrow afternoon.
That's right. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, next we have an update on workers' comp self-insure employer group legislation. Mr. Allen and Mr. Schultz.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department Department of Consumer and Business Services. And joining me today is John Shields, who's the administrator of the department's Workers' Compensation Division. We want to give you just a quick update on Senate Bill 1558, which passed in the February short session. To refresh your memory, in workers' compensation, most employers obtain their insurance through a commercial insurance carrier. A subset of larger employers self-insure, so they hire a third-party administrator who takes care of claims, but they pay them directly. And there's a small subset of businesses that are too small to self-insure that band together in groups and form an entity that's a self-insured trust of some sort. And this is an area that about a year or so ago, we became quite concerned about a high degree of instability for a variety of reasons, ranging from still echoing problems from the recession to pricing and management issues and just a range of things that were causing us to be very nervous that these groups were in jeopardy of failure. Working with a number of stakeholders, came back with a bill in the February session that did a number of things, basically trying to create an orderly exit from this system for those groups that for which that was appropriate. Authorized us to use the Worker Benefit Fund to transition that orderly exit, and then authorized us to create new and improved standards for the remaining groups. And basically, we're here to report to you that everything seems to have worked pretty much just exactly as we had hoped that it would. There are two groups that when we came to you were already in bankruptcy or insolvent. Almost immediately, we began using the authority that we had under the bill to pay claims for the nonprofit Oregon Nonprofit Employers Trust, and to date we've paid a little bit less than $200,000 of claims for that group, relieving us of the need to go after these often very small, undercapitalized nonprofits to try to get those funds. The bankruptcy trustee for the Construction Industry Trust is continuing to pay out of previous assessments, but we expect that we'll take over responsibility for that group sometime in the next 6 to 9 months. The third group that we were most concerned about, Oregon Employers Trust, a general diversified trust, did make an election to liquidate and take advantage of the orderly transition. Right now, they are beginning to pay claims out of the security deposits that we maintain, and we expect to begin paying again sometime within about the next year or so out of that fund. We've adopted new standards for the remaining groups. There are now four self-insured groups that remain, two public sector groups, two private sector groups. Those new standards go into effect today, as a matter of fact, and we will begin applying those standards as these groups come up for renewal over the next 6 months as their certifications come due. I think we told you back in February that we thought that the total cost of this would be something under $10 million, and we continue to believe that that's the case. Our projections now are quite a bit fresher than they were at that time, and we've got more specific information, and we're really being able to dial that number in and be fairly comfortable with it. The last thing I'll update and then see if you have questions. You may recall there's an assessment on workers' compensation premiums, a tax, and that we have an upcharge on that tax for self-insured groups to fund reserve accounts. And last year when we were here, we had significantly increased that upcharge for self-insured groups, and we were faced with potentially having to increase it yet quite a bit more. Based on where we are today, we have now been able for the public sector groups to drop that surcharge back to what it was previously. We're going to maintain the higher surcharge for one more year for the private sector groups, just to ensure that we're out of the woods in terms of stability, but we anticipate being able to drop that surcharge back to its historic level as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer easy questions, and John would love to take the hard ones.
Thank you. Any easy questions for Mr. Allen? Any hard questions for Mr. Schultz? Okay, great. Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Holder.
I hate to be the only one that asks questions. So in listening to you, I'm curious, is there something that we're going to be working on that's going to prevent this fund from, I won't say bailing out these self-employed programs in the future? Or,
yeah, thanks, Chair.
I mean, are we changing the standards so we're not going to see our trust funds continue to be depleted by some of these programs that aren't properly setting aside enough money.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey. Two things about that. First, the standards that we're imposing by rule now are higher financial performance standards for the remaining groups that are designed to increase the margin of error so that we think it's much, much less likely that we would find ourselves in a situation like this. Also, we have a responsibility now to report back to the Management Labor Advisory Committee periodically about the stability of these groups and the status of the Worker Benefit Fund and Worker Benefit Fund contributions toward this program. And so we'll have one additional kind of check and balance on our administration of the program as well. So we feel confident that that the combination of the orderly exit of the unstable groups and the higher standards for the remaining stable groups should keep us out of this kind of a circumstance in the future.
Thank you. Any further follow-up questions? I do have one question. When they talk about the rates, you said that the surcharge is going to be kept in place for mm-hmm. private sector. When is that determination made? What month? What time of the year for planning?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we just actually last week announced the full range of data points related to workers' compensation insurance. So we announced the pure premium rate, which is kind of the keystone rate that companies use to base their charges. That rate came down about 5%. That's its second increase consecutively and over the period of about 30 years, one of many, many years with decreases based on historic reforms. Mm-hmm. 20-plus years ago. We also announced the premium assessment, which is that tax on rates, which remains stable, and then these surcharges. So that all happens about this time of year, and we did that last week.
I was just wondering for budgeting processes and that kind of thing. So, okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen,
very much.
Okay. Next, we have talking about the work share program with federal regulations. Mr. Gershenfeld, and is Betsy coming up, Ms. Earls? And anybody else from your shop? Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Gershenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Oregon Employment Department. Wanted to share some information about Oregon's WorkShare program today. Oregon has a nationally recognized WorkShare program, and it's something that helps employers avoid layoffs. So it's optional for employers. If they're looking at possibly having to lay off some employees, instead of doing those layoffs, they can reduce the hours of a broader number of employees. The employees who have their hours reduced then receive some unemployment insurance benefits to partially offset the wages that they lose. They get to remain employed so that they don't become long-term unemployed, and they get to retain their any benefits that they have, health benefits, with their employer. For the employer, it helps them retain a skilled workforce, so when business picks up, they don't have to go out and try to find people with the specialized skills and training that they've already paid for. In 2012, there were some federal legislative changes to the program. Oregon had a bill in 2013, Senate Bill 192, that made changes to Oregon law to match those federal changes. At the time we made those changes, the Department of Labor certified that with those changes, Oregon was in conformity or consistent with federal law. They had some changes in federal interpretation, though, and in April of this year, they informed us that there were two provisions of Oregon law that we needed to change to stay consistent with federal law. If we don't stay consistent, then Oregon would either lose the funding for its unemployment insurance program or need to stop having the WorkShare program. So I wanted to explain what those two changes are and then why I'm talking about them today and not waiting until 2015. A legislative concept has been proposed to make these two changes that I'm about to talk about. The first change, the law says that when an employer wants to participate in this program, they tell us how much they're going to reduce each employee's hours, and by statute it needs to be in the 20% to 40% range. Those provisions are fine with the Department of Labor, but we have a provision that they said we do need to remove. That provision says that if an employee works more hours than the plan originally anticipated, the worker doesn't receive any work share benefits. So if the employer enters into a plan with us and says we expect to reduce each employee's work week by 10 hours during this time period, and they get a little bit of extra work 1 week, so they only reduce the person's hours by, say, or work week by 8 hours that week, if we don't do something, the worker doesn't receive any work share benefits for the week. So the Department of Labor said that we need to remove that provision, that it's inconsistent with its new interpretation of federal law. As a practical matter, this isn't much of a change in outcome in Oregon. What we have done is, when the circumstance comes up, we've worked with employers and asked them to amend their work share plan so that the workers aren't penalized when they go in to work a couple of extra hours when the employer has that available. It will save some administrative burden on the employers who are using the program and on the department to have those constant amendments to the plan. The second change that we need to make is, right now, when an employer uses the work share program a lot, at a certain point they can hit a threshold where the benefits that we pay to workers have to be reimbursed dollar for dollar by the employer, rather than just being factored into the math formula that determines their unemployment insurance tax rate. The Department of Labor says that we can't do that, that we need to treat the work share benefits the same as regular unemployment insurance benefits. So those are the two changes that have been put forward in a legislative concept for the 2015 session, and the Department of Labor has said that pursuing it then is fine for Oregon being in conformity with federal law. That is not in time, however, for us to be able to apply for some federal grant funds that are available. So there's about $1.189 million in federal grant funds that the Department of Labor has available for states specifically for the work share program. There are some timelines, though, and we have to apply by the end of this year. They only have 30 days to approve or deny the grant requests, and they have to deny the grant request if we are then not in conformity with federal law. So the legislative concept for 2015 does not get us there quickly enough to be able to apply for those grant funds. There is a statute in the unemployment insurance laws that says if there is a federal program that would bring additional unemployment insurance money from the federal government into Oregon and would benefit Oregonians, that the governor can direct the employment department to implement that program. And on August 19th, the governor did issue a letter to the employment department directing us to implement these changes to the work share program so that we're able to apply for these federal grant funds. We already have legislative authority to apply for about $790,000 of the grant funds, and we anticipate submitting that application shortly. And we'll be seeking authority later this morning to apply for the remaining $400,000 in grant funds. We have reached out to both the business and labor community. The labor community is not here this morning, but I understand there was a submission from AFL-CIO expressing their support. And those are the changes, and just wanted to make sure that this committee was aware of the changes and why these are being implemented prior to the 2015 session, when we do anticipate discussing this again or being available to have any policy discussions with the committee. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions or turn it over to Ms. Earls.
Okay, thank you. Just for the record, you do have a letter from Ilana Guinea from AFL-CIO for the record supporting this concept. Any questions of David? Jim? Representative Widener?
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Still on vacation.
Just real quick, because I've been approached by some constituents in the district or businesses that use this, and one of them is the school bus drivers, and I'm wondering if there's been any account for bus drivers in this, because they'll work during the school year, then they're laid off over the summer, and then they'll go to draw unemployment, and then they're denied the unemployment benefits over the summer. If they would need to partake in this to help offset that, or how that can be dealt with.
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, that's not directly related to the work share program. There are some other unemployment insurance rules that apply specifically to school district employees, and I don't have all that information in front of me, but I'd be happy to follow up with you after that. These changes don't impact the way the bus drivers are dealt with, so this wouldn't either hurt them, but it wouldn't help the issue that you're talking about.
Well, they're technically not a district employee, because it'll be a private company that, like First Student, whoever, who's contracted with the school district. And I'm just wondering if this would be a program that they should look at getting involved with that would ease things with what they're dealing with for their employees, or?
Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, it's something certainly worth looking into, and I'd be happy to talk to them or have them talk with our experts. There are some restrictions around not using the work share program when it is a recurring seasonal issue, so that might be a challenge, but we can look at the definitions and how that would play out and see if this might be a good tool for them.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Ms. Earls?
All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI represents about 1,400 or 1,500 employers across the state, and many of them have used the WorkShare program to great success and have very much appreciated being able to keep their employees on in slowdown situations and keep that skilled labor force, skilled up and ready to go again when things pick up. Both of the problems that the Employment Department has described to you are, they do represent hassles for employers that are using the WorkShare program. And, you know, certainly those hassles are not insurmountable, and we have been, you know, working with them and getting past them. But we would appreciate the chance to have those fixed, and, you know, the sooner the better, I would say. And since this is a good time to go ahead and do that so that it allows the department to apply for grant funding, we support their request or their the work that they're doing, and wanted you to know that.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to take a moment publicly to thank the Assistant Director. During the interim, I had the opportunity to call him about a situation, and he was very kind with his time and very helpful in understanding how an unemployment claim worked. So thank you for indulging me during that time. So I may not get a chance to thank you again. I'm sort of finishing up my time here, so but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I do have one question. With this is more of an information for us, is that the governor does have the authority to go through and you know, direct you to file for grants and so on. And so this is more informational. Is there anything that we need to do before we meet again in January, February?
Chair Doherty, correct. This is informational. We just wanted to, I don't think there's anything this committee needs to do unless they have concerns about these two changes, mm-hmm. which we anticipate will be in that legislative concept. So if there are concerns, we're certainly happy to meet with members to understand those and try to address them.
Right. So it's just a matter of the federal government says they need it by this date, and we're not meeting till this date.
Absolutely correct, Chair Doherty. Right.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, next, Mr. Rogers. Okay, while Mr. Rogers is getting settled, I do want to give a little background to Brian Rogers. He is the new director, executive director for the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust. And for close to 20 years, he worked with the Pennsylvania Arts Commission. And he was deputy director of the Pennsylvania Council of Arts for 16 years. He's an accomplished artist himself and has a bachelor's degree in fine arts from the Tyler School of Art at Temple University, and majored in painting. And he also has a master's degree in fine art from the Graduate School of Art at the University of Arizona. And so on behalf of at least the Business and Labor Committee, we welcome you to the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. My name is Brian Rogers. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Arts Commission and the Oregon Cultural Trust. And I'd like to thank Representative Daugherty for this opportunity to be here today to update you on the work of the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust. We're on an exciting time period right now because both the Trust and the Commission are about to engage in strategic long-range planning processes. And we are we're a department of the Business Oregon. And Business Oregon is also in the process of developing a strategic plan that will enable all of the departments within Business Oregon to serve the citizens of the state at a higher level. And our department, both the Trust and the Commission, offer arts and cultural grants and direct services across the state to roughly 1,300 organizations that provide services to the citizens and also play a major role in the quality of life in Oregon. The programs and services that we offer enable the attraction of businesses and the retention of people to stay across the state. The planning processes that we will engage in will have a strong, very interactive public component. We are Right now, developing a schedule of about 12 to 15 public meetings across the state that will gain a lot of information and data about what issues folks are facing, as well as what opportunities they'd like to take advantage of to further increase the visibility of their own communities. Last week, Thursday and Friday, both the Cultural Trust and the Commission had their board meetings in Warm Springs, and it was tremendous to be welcomed by that community. One of the very important things that we did for the first time ever is had a joint meeting with the Commission and the Trust to kick off the planning process. And in that meeting, both boards were able to share a lot of information and data with each other and start to build a collaborative sense of how we could work together. The Trust, of course, works with the arts, humanities, heritage, and history in the state. The Arts Commission is really focused, of course, on the arts and enabling a lot of work in both both areas of ongoing support for organizations, and artists builds communities, and we also manage the state's percent for art program for public buildings. The Cultural Trust does work with 43 county coalitions and tribes, nine tribes, that offer a lot of re-grant dollars in communities. They're able to respond to local circumstances with a high degree of responsibility. And those county coalitions are actually gathering across the state right now in regional gatherings. So three or four county coalitions are getting together. At this moment, we are actually conducting one in Astoria. And the concept is to hear directly from them about how we can enable them to do things better and what opportunities they can take advantage of. Coming up on October 1st through the 3rd, we will be a part of the Main Street Conference in McMinnville, and we are actually offering a service or a session there that will focus on arts and culture and Main Street programs. And on October 6th, we will be at the in Bend conducting our Arts Summit, which will bring in leaders from all across the Central Oregon to talk about how arts and culture are playing a big role in Central Oregon. We're working very closely with the Regional Solution Office and the Foundation Center, the National Foundation Center. They're going to name the library in Bend one of their resource centers, as well as the Nonprofit Center for Oregon. Their conference is the day after. So we're looking to make sure that a lot of our attendees can go to that session as well to hear about nonprofit issues. Welcome any questions or thoughts.
Great. Any questions, Mr. Rogers? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rogers, can you give us some ballpark numbers? I'm sitting here thinking about the trust, and I don't really remember and just what your income level is, the trust level, and your expenditures are.
Yes, thank you.
Just in general terms, I don't need details, but I'm just trying to understand the rough numbers.
The trust right now is at about 8,600 people last year donated to the trust, and that generated about, and we also have about 20 corporations, and the maximum tax credit allowable is $500. So those 8,500 people generated about $4 million.
Wow.
And roughly half of that goes back into the corpus of the trust, and the other half is granted out through a number of programs and services. And over the past several years, the trend of folks who donate is increasing about 10% per year.
Yeah. And then expenditures.
Expenditures about $2 million in last fiscal year.
Okay.
That were granted out.
Okay. And with that, is that set by statute, the kind of the formula that's used for grant donations?
Yes, Madam Chair. It, thank you. It is set by statute that over 50%, about 53% is used to put back into the corpus, and the remaining is granted out through direct grants from the trust, through coalition grants, as well as partner grants.
Thank you. Yeah, and if I remember correctly, we had an effort last session to repeal part of that tax benefit that's there, and it was unsuccessful, right? That's maybe newer history for you.
It was renewed because it was up. It was sunsetting.
It was sunsetting, not to repeal.
We had to affirmatively renew it, and we did.
Yeah, that's great. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Glad to contribute to it, by the way.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Rogers. I just wanted to welcome you. Your reputation precedes you. A lot of us who are active in the arts community, we're very excited to have you. Your organizations, two of them, if you look at the overall sweep of the Oregon state government, it's very, very small, but has an enormous impact, I think, on the quality of life in the state. Really appreciate what you do. We in Oregon, we're really proud of the cultural trust, this model, and we're excited to have you shepherd it for this time. It's an exciting thing. It's very cool.
Madam Chair and Representative Barton, I appreciate that comment very much. And I think everyone on both the Board of the Trust and the Commission and the staff and all those involved across the state are very excited to have this opportunity to plan and think about the future and really integrate the arts and culture at a higher level. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Holby.
Thank you. Could you elaborate a little bit about what the Main Street program is?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Holby. The Main Street program is really about, and it's a national concept, which is to promote Main Street in small communities or towns, and from local businesses moving in to creating a sense of place to enabling travel and tourism. The arts and culture fit into that very well because they're able to think about small galleries or performance or renovated theater, like the Egyptian Theater in Coos Bay. Renovation is not only spins off a lot of jobs locally with contractors and restoration folks, but it also helps to create a well-being in the community, that there is a place to go and convene and be a part of what's going on.
Thank you. I was because I participated in some events previously that really highlighted the economic impact of arts and business and that sort of alliance that there was a nationwide study in some places in Oregon were highlighted as far as the economic impact of arts and the amount of small businesses that are in Oregon and really a growing industry, in fact. And I'm curious along those lines whether you mentioned Business Oregon and being a part of that. Do we have specific small business loans that are geared towards the arts and the industries and businesses that are developed in that culture, I guess?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Holby. That's exactly the kind of thing that we hope emerges from this planning process, the ability to, leverage our work and to be able to provide some kinds of loans to organizations to help them with working capital and venture capital. That's a big part of what Business Oregon does, is to help grow businesses in the state. And the discussions we've started right now are really focused on that, how we can play a role in that. So it's a very timely question.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could follow up on Representative Holvey, I think Representative Freeman and Hannah had a Main Street program in 2009 that would have created like 40,000 jobs, wasn't it, as well?
It was a job creator.
Your job creator was tax incentive for businesses that kind of flows into what he's doing with his Main Street program.
Okay. And I had one question about the Main Street. What date was the, thank you, what date was the McMinnville?
Madam Chair, it's October 1st through the 3rd.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is the City of Tigard is dealing with this and where they're taking We're redesigning the entire Main Street, and so many Main Streets have, like, flower baskets and so on. We have a small business that teaches glass blowing, and so we're thinking of having blown glass on our light posts instead of flowers. So I'm sure that the downtown group would be interested in going to that. Okay, any other comments, questions? Okay, thank you very much. And on behalf of the House of Representatives member on the Oregon Cultural Trust, welcome to Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, and last but not least, Ms. Miles, small business advocate for the Office of the Secretary of State. Oh, one thing before we go into that. If you have time, Mr. Rogers, to wander around the Capitol, on every floor of the Capitol, on both the House and the Senate side, are examples of art by artists in Oregon. And one that's kind of overlooked is there is a tunnel. Of course, it took me 5 years to find it, from the Capitol over to the Public Services Building. And down there is artwork from the Oregon Youth Authority clients. And that is very, very good. And so if you've got time to go through and wander around and look at the artwork, it would be great. Actually, it's very good.
Thank you.
Well, hopefully it won't take you 5 years to find the tunnel.
There's a tunnel.
There's a tunnel.
There's a tunnel.
I've been hanging out there for years.
Well, we know that. We saw you down there.
The state police know where to find you now.
Yeah, really. Out of the tunnel. Okay, thank you. Ruth?
Tara Doherty, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. For the record, I am Ruth Miles. I'm the small business advocate. I run the Office of Small Business Assistance for Oregon Secretary of State. As you recall, this office was legislatively created in 2013, and it was just opened in January of this year. And what I do is assist small businesses that need help in their dealings with executive branch agencies. And that covers a huge spectrum of issues. Through all the inquiries that we receive in my office, through that whole spectrum, my job is pretty clear. First job is to fix the problem for the business if it's fixable. Second, I'm looking for systemic issues that are occurring within agencies that might cause the same problem to happen repeatedly. And I'm reporting back, and that's what I do here. So on one end of the spectrum of inquiry received by my office, we get what I call one and done questions. Excuse me, these are things like, do I need a BIN number? What's the difference between a BIN number and an EIN? What's the difference between that and a registry number? Do I need all three of these things? And so I'm happy to answer questions like that or connect people with the resources that give them that information. There's also a lot of inquiries, and I'm very happy about this, from people who are interested in starting a business for the first time or starting a new business that's a separate one from what they already have. And those folks, I generally refer to the Small Business Development Centers because they're so well equipped to provide training and support to businesses that are interested in getting started. We also get policy questions from businesses occasionally. For instance, a few weeks ago, I met with the owner of Ringo's Lakeside Marina on 10 Mile Lake, and that's out in Representative McEwen and Senator Roblin's districts. Kathy, who owns the marina, wanted to know about the uses of her waterway lease dollars. She said, you know, we've got a weed problem that happens during the summer, and if we don't take care of the weeds, then as a boat comes up to their marina, the prop gets fouled. Now, she takes care of her weeds. She uses kind of a razor affair on a pole, and they just kind of run through and make sure that those weeds are down. Her neighbor does not do that. And so, but they have a public dock, and as boats approach, she said, you can hear it. Now, this is kind of a benefit for Kathy in an odd way because they also offer mechanic services at her marina, but she doesn't want to see that happen. She wants to see the lake used, and so she wanted to find out more about that. And in contacting Department of State Lands, I found out that they actually have a piece of legislation that will come before you in 2015 that's meant to address that problem. Kathy is thrilled to have a copy of the legislation in its draft form, and I'm fairly certain that she's going to support that and probably most of the population of Lakeside. So if you've ever been to Lakeside, those folks are pretty excited about that. So these are really important issues to address, but what I spend most of my time working on are issues where a business has a really complex issue with a state agency. They've done everything they know how to do, and the problem is still there. And in almost every case, communication has broken down to some extent, and the situation calls for an objective third party to step in with a helping hand. So as you know, the Secretary of State is her own constitutional office. By extension, And as her appointee, I'm also outside the executive branch. And that gives me the ability to have objectivity in these circumstances. So I can work with both state agencies and businesses to find a solution to their problems. I've met with a number of you individually. So some of you have heard detail about some of the casework that I've done, and some of you haven't. So because of that, I want to get kind of to the numbers and tell you about the activity of the office thus far. So this is as of the morning of September 11th. And let me just... I did these numbers earlier than that as I was writing my testimony, and they change almost every day because I'm opening and closing cases on a pretty regular basis. So please keep in mind that these are as of the morning of September 11th. At that time, I had a total of 67 cases. Those are active and closed. And you'll notice in the breakout to the right of that, it says non-SF. Nine of them are non-SF and 58 are SF. And what that is really a reference for me, and it says to me that I've got 58 of those in my case management system. Nine of them were opened and closed before we were able to deploy my case management system. Deployment of that system was delayed because of problems the Secretary of State experienced during February. I think you all knew about that. And so that deployment had to wait until we dealt with all of the other problems with our online presence and applications. So of those 67 cases, on the morning of September 11th, I had 14 active cases. Two of those were reopened cases. So I didn't create a new case. I just reopened a case. And the two are Crossroads and Linda Dugan. Linda Dugan is an insurance agent who is having some difficulty getting paid commissions from Cover Oregon. This is not an unfamiliar problem to you, so I'm not going to go into it in great detail. Crossroads, I'll talk about a little bit later. 48 of those 67 cases I closed with no findings issued, and five I closed with findings. So close with no findings issued means that I haven't found any opportunities for improvement on the part of the state agency. They've done everything that I can see that they should do, and usually there's some sort of misunderstanding or just a simple, honest mistake on the part of the business that caused the problem to surface and come to my office in the beginning. Closed with findings represents those cases where I have found opportunities for improvement in state agencies. And so I'll talk a little bit more about those findings later on. So looking at all of the cases as a universe, you have a pie chart in front of you. And this is why you have a corrected version of my testimony. If those of you who were looking at this earlier may have noticed that half of it was the total. So I mistakenly included a figure in there that shouldn't have been in there, the total of all the cases. So what you see here is a representation of where these different cases, both those reported with findings and those that didn't have findings, what they fall into in terms of problem category. Like, why were these people calling for help? So if you look at referred cases, that's 31% of the pie here. And this is a mixed bag. It's a huge mixed bag of cases. A lot of those are referrals to small business development centers. Some of them are referrals to other advocates or ombudsmen within state government. And some of them are referrals to other levels of government, whether federal or local, usually local. The biggest trend I'm seeing, though, right now is licensing issues. And you see that that is 36% of the pie here. And so I broke that out separately. And you can see that there's three little categories there. There's other, there's HCRQI, and I'm WSBI. So HCRQI stands for healthcare regulation and quality improvement. This office is part of the Oregon Health Authority. They regulate a wide range of healthcare providers, and I've included a whole list in your testimony. I'm not going to do that because half of these are really hard to pronounce. I will tell you, though, that all of the cases in my office involve in-home care agencies. These are agencies that you could hire if you had, say, an elderly parent who needed assistance, or a special needs adult or child who needed assistance to stay in the home and not be institutionalized. So of those HCRQI cases, I've issued findings on one closed case. I have two open cases. Of those two open cases, one of them is likely to result in findings. The third, it's a little too soon to tell for me to know whether or not there's any wrongdoing on the part of the agency. And frankly, I think the fact that I have additional cases from this office is not due to any malfeasance on the part of the office. It really is just a matter of them making changes fast enough to deal with the business climate. So I'm continuing to hear complaints from businesses because the changes haven't been made fast enough. So going on to WSBI, you heard about that a little bit earlier from Representative Gomberg. It's the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, and they're part of Business Oregon, as you know. They certify businesses for the purposes of participating in state and local procurement opportunities. Of the four OMWSB cases that have thus far come through my office, I'll only issue findings in one case. So three of those cases have been closed with no findings. The problems have been dealt with, primarily because the OMWSB office was willing to reach out to individual businesses and work with them on that level to hear about their concerns and their complaints. The other case is currently in the reporting process. So the report is not yet finished. So I don't have that for you today, but it should be out hopefully within the next month, depending on timing at the agency side. So I mentioned these two offices only because I've had repeat business from them, and that is unusual given the number of months that I've been in business. There isn't a lot of opportunity for an agency to have kind of repeat problems, and yet these two specific offices within agencies have had definite repeated problems. So I just wanted to highlight that for you. The other licensing issues, and that's that big 71% figure that's in the green on the pie chart, are a huge spectrum of issues. And just to give you some of the stories behind this, got a call from Liz. Liz wanted to know if she could manufacture soap in a home kitchen and sell it at a local farmer's market. She just didn't know what the regulatory environment was, and I didn't either. So I had to do quite a bit of investigation, and this was a several, you know, multi-agency kind of investigation to find out what do you need to do to make soap in a home kitchen and sell it at a farmer's market. And I found out that this is not a highly regulated industry, and, you know, Liz needed to register her business with a corporation division if she was going to use a business name other than her personal real and true name, and she needed to be a member of her farmer's market, get a local business license. She was good to go. So Liz was thrilled to hear about that. Scott wanted to pay his OLCC fees to the OLCC in cash. He wanted to be able to take a $5 bill to pay a $2.68 fee and be able to get change back. At the time Scott first talked to me, which was at a meeting of the Umpqua Wine Growers Association in your district. In fact, this is one of your constituents, I believe, that brought up this concern. Scott did actually bring a $5 bill to an OLCC office in Roseburg to pay a $2.68 fee, and they did everything. They personally all pulled out handbags trying to figure out if somebody had change and couldn't make change for it at, you know, the end of the day on a Friday, and yet Scott was on the cusp of opening the first urban winery in Roseburg. Pretty important stuff. He has no time at all. I mean, he needs 27 hours a day and, you know, eight days a week. So he had to go back and deal with this in a, you know, like take a check for $2.68. And Scott's point to me was, you know, they can have cash tills in these offices. What's the problem with that? And so I contacted the OLCC and I said, is there a reason that you don't have cash tills in the offices? Have you had other inquiries asking for this? And they had. This is actually kind of on the top of their list in terms of things that they were hearing about from their field offices. And so they, on a very, very tight timeline, did a smart little rule change, deployed cash tills in their offices, and I was able to get in touch with Scott and the rest of the Wine Growers Association in the Umpqua Valley and say, hey, problem fixed. And the problem is fixed because you guys spoke up. So they were pretty excited about that. Not everything is a happy story in my office, and Max's jerky is one of those not so happy stories. Max's wife called me because she wanted to understand if her husband was compliant with his business. He was making meat jerky in a room they'd built off of their house and sanitizing his tools in their kitchen dishwasher. So I found out what the road was from where they're at to get completely compliant. And I will say to you that that is a long and expensive road. And that was sad for me to have to tell her, but she knows what she needs to do in order to get compliant if they want to continue with this business, and that's the important thing. And then I have to tell you about Ann. Ann owns Mobius Microfarms. Yes.
You brought up that one. Is it all right, Madam Chair?
Why don't we wait until she's completed the report, and then we'll ask questions on that one.
Thank you. So Ann owns Mobius Microfarms. She invented a self-contained unit. It's kind of encased in a cedar bookcase, I guess, for lack of a better term. If you want to see a picture of it, I've got one on my phone. I can show you after the hearing. But Ann's system has a little fish tank in it, And that fish tank is used to water microgreens that are grown in the unit. And so that's things like, it's everything from basil to like pea shoots and things like that. These are a high cost item for restaurants to purchase. But when you look at, especially micro herbs, they have all of the flavor that a full size herb would have. It's all packed into a tiny little package. And so they're a very popular thing to finish a dish with. The problem that Anne came to me with is she said, you know, I've been told by the public health department of Oregon Health Authority that restaurants can't harvest these greens, and that's why I can't sell a unit to a restaurant and then just provide them with service and kind of oversight. What I found out is that that wasn't the case. Restaurants can indeed harvest the greens. The problem here is that Anne's system, it's a closed little ecosystem, and it uses fish effluent as the fertilizing ingredient. And because of that, federal law prohibits these from being sold to the restaurants and used there. And did, at the time we met, have a unit in a restaurant which she owned. She would harvest the greens. She would take them to another spot and do all of the washing and sanitizing that is appropriate, that FDA requires, and then would bring them back and sell them to the restaurant at a low fee. As a business model, that did not work. However, Anne is one of those people that I'm just really privileged to meet in this position. Anne is one of those amazing innovators. She's got a brilliant mind, she's a hard worker, and she's super smart and educated. And I hope that Anne takes a look, now that she knows what the regulatory hurdle is, I think that she's going to try to create some sort of unit that does not have the fish tank in it, but still is able to do kind of a closed system. So I have great hopes for Anne. Because she's got a real passion to grow food sustainably in small spaces. So moving on to the other top issues that you see in those pie chart breakouts, that first pie chart, taxes and procurement are both about 9%. Most of the tax cases represent small business owners that are confused about how to comply with tax law. Contractors versus employees, it's an issue that's come up. Foreign entities hiring their first employee within the state of Oregon, that's come up several times. Procurement cases have resulted in a couple of reports real quickly. The first one was Devin James Group. Devin had two contracts with Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. The company had invoiced the state for about $40,000 over 2 months, and no payments had been received at the time he first contacted me. There was a series of errors on both the business side and the agency side that caused this to happen. We got the delay resolved, the payments started to flow. So the problem was fixed. The systemic issue that was at play here is the ORPIN system. And this is DAS's procurement system. It's used not only to showcase vendors and their profiles. You heard about that as far as certified firms. Those folks have a profile in ORPIN, but it's also used to pay bills. Contractors in that system can have several addresses associated with one company. And the system, as I understand it, does not have the ability to designate one particular address for a billing address. That was the problem at play here. And so in an effort, because the electronic funds payment was not set up in this case in a really timely fashion, DAS sent a paper check out, but they sent it to the Memphis, Tennessee address of Devin James Group, which is a multi-state, small, minority-owned business. Now, Memphis had no bearing on any of the contracts held by this company with Oregon. There were only two offices that they had that were listed in our contracts. The first was Portland and the other was Seattle. And it should have gone there. We found out that it was really a USPS error. The Postal Service didn't deliver this whole thing. They didn't deliver the check to the Memphis, Tennessee address. And so there was concern that it was misaddressed. It was not. It was correctly addressed to Tennessee. It just shouldn't have been sent to Tennessee to begin with. And so there really is a systemic issue there. And I don't know if DAS has been able to correct that or not. But I've encouraged DHS, as a user of the ORPIN system, to work with them to get that figured out so that it doesn't happen to other people. The second procurement report dealt with Crossroads Nonviolence Education. And they're actually from Representative Gomberg's district. They have two contracts, at least two, and it may be more now because they're a real go-getter, with DHS field offices. And they do parenting classes, nonviolent education, and kind of the like. Unlike Devin James Group, Crossroads was receiving payments in a timely fashion, but all the remittance information accompanying those payments was incorrect. Essentially, what it boils down to is that DHS, to manage their vendors of this type and their participants, uses a system called ORCIDS. And the ORCIDS system was fairly recently deployed, in terms of just a few years ago. Right after deployment, the DHS Office of Financial Services noticed that the system was generating its own contract numbers. And so from the time of deployment until now, every single vendor that gets payments through ORCIDS was getting payment information that had nothing to do with their contracts. So that might not be a problem if you have one contract, you're sending one invoice. In this case, these guys had several contracts, which they were tracking separately because they were each different kinds of services and different kinds of products, I guess you could say. So they would send an invoice for one program and an invoice for another one to DHS. They would get one payment back that was covering all of these things, but they would not be able to tell which invoices had been paid. So I'm really happy to say that we got that fixed. So the long and short of it is that in fixing this particular application, DHS prioritized things that dealt with kid safety at the top of their list of things to fix for the ORCIDS program. So they did that first, and as a result, it took a few years for them to get to accounting things. This does present a real problem. I have heard just anecdotally stories about businesses that have been audited because they were incorrectly, well, they weren't able to identify the specific income they'd received from the state in relationship to their actual invoices. So hopefully that has come to a close right now. So Crossroads did, they received their September payment for August activity, and it finally had correct remittance information and invoice numbers. They couldn't be more thrilled, and I was as well. So that's a really kind of swift update in terms of the complex cases I've had, but I want to make sure that you had an opportunity to take a look at findings from my office. And so I'd included those with my original testimony. This is the report for Northwest Trucking Academy. It was the first case to come through my office. So I mentioned previously that the purpose of issuing findings is to highlight a systemic issue that I've found, or a group of issues that I've found in an agency that could cause a problem to happen again. Each report's broken down into sections. So there's a summary of the problem, what I did to advocate for the business and work with them, and that would be in the advocacy and action sections, my conclusions about the problem, and any historical or contextual information that has bearing on the issue, and certainly my recommendations for the whole situation. And you'll see that there's also a section reserved for comments from the agency. So if you're looking at your report, it would be on page 2 under the very bottom of the page. The last paragraph starts comments from the agency. So in the case before you, David Stahl, who's the owner of Northwest Trucking Academy, wanted to teach people how to drive a truck and get them ready for their commercial driver's license. So you don't have to run a fleet of trucks to know the importance of having people who have CDLs. If you've ever gotten a package via UPS or FedEx, then a commercial driver's license holder was involved. If you buy melons from Hermiston at your local grocery store, then there was probably several CDL holders involved. So these are important folks. David clearly had market share in his area. He contacted my office because he'd applied for a private career school license 7 months prior, but it had taken him that entire 7 months to get to step 2 of an 8-step licensing process. And this was in the private career school licensing unit, which is part of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. In this case, there were issues on both sides. Dave, the business owner, was struggling to deal with what he saw as legalistic and overcomplicated correspondence coming from this office, but that really just had simple requests for information. The licensing unit, in the meantime, has a very skilled staff, but they are very small, and they were working with outdated tools, to put it nicely. And they were trying to manage a backup of 32 schools. So not just Dave, but 31 other schools were waiting for their initial license when I walked in the door to meet with them. And that was back in January. So their ability to get things done was really hampered by their budget. And their budget in this case is entirely comprised of fees that are paid. So initial licensing fees, relicensing fees, and then also a little certification fee for cosmetology teachers. But in the end, my recommendations were pretty straightforward. I asked the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to take a look at the fee schedule for the office. with an eye to funding technology upgrades and the possible addition of FTEs. And I want to make sure that you understand, I do think that it might be possible for them to work through that backlog with their existing FTEs, but they have got to have modern tools in order to do it. I asked them to consider automating their license application materials where it's possible. And I think you could probably even use a tool like SurveyMonkey to do that. It's kind of like when you order flowers for your spouse on Valentine's Day. If you do that online, you've got to give them credit number, a credit card number, and your security code. And if you don't do that, they won't let you click submit on the order. You've got to go back. It kind of highlights the field, or you get the red asterisk. And so they know, you know, you've got to go back and get that field corrected. These guys need similar technology, but not the level of financial security that you would have even with a corner florist that has this kind of online application. These guys just need to be able to require certain kinds of fields. So that's one of the things I was asking them to do, as well as create a database that has collaborative digital file management for their new licensees, which they did not have when I walked in the door. They were using legal-size accordion files instead. So there were 32 schools with those legal-size accordion files and five people working on those files. So real big problem there. But they really embraced the whole idea of having somebody from the outside come into their agency and make recommendations about workflow and process. And they have made a huge number of changes. Dave did get licensed, schools in session, and so that was a good thing to have happen. And you may know, if you read the report, Dave was not licensed at the time I issued findings. He was licensed in May of this year. So this was a very, very rapid view of what's been going on with my office, but I wanted to give you something that was comprehensive. That's what I've got for you, but if you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain those.
Okay. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ruth, actually, we ran out into each other out in some of the businesses and stuff, and I've seen you and out there actually in quite a few different places, and I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
What you came up here, you were talking about Scott and all these different people, and you have a pretty good summary of things that have happened here. But I'm wondering if we could have more interaction, if nothing else, with the chair, so we can actually start doing corrective actions legislatively to take care of a lot of these problems. Because I think it's going to be hard for you if you don't have our support going forward with this. And I think we need to close that loop of communication. I don't know if any discussions have went on with you and the chair over that, or you know, my door is always open, and I'm sure most of the members here, but I would like to see us actually do something with the information that you're providing us. So,
Chair Doherty, Representative,
go ahead.
Representative Winder, thank you for the expression of support. I really appreciate that, and I will use it. I'll tell you that I have copies of all of the reports. The chair, I believe, has copies of all of the findings issued by my office. And in the recommendations section, it's fairly clear whether or not there's a statutory issue at play or if it's an ORS at play. I don't have any legislative requests for the 2015 session, partly because of the filing deadlines for Secretary of State. So that was at the time our filing deadlines happened, which in my case was back in August. There may be legislation that I would be interested in asking you to consider introducing, and so I'll definitely keep that in mind moving forward. A lot of that has to do with cases that are active right now. They've not been closed, and so coming to a final conclusion about whether or not legislation would be an avenue to provide a long-term solution isn't necessarily clear.
Okay, other questions, comments? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ruth, thank you for being here. This whole concept was a little bit difficult for me to get my mind around, and I did finally support it, and I'm really glad I did. Having you there, I think, has made the idea of this really work a lot better than what I assumed it would. The whole idea of having to have a department to help coordinate businesses working with agencies, you know, only in government does it make sense to do it that way rather than to take some of the regulatory hurdles away. But I think you're doing both. I think you're finding those ways to help businesses through the difficulties of regulation, and then you're looking for those opportunities to reduce or at least streamline some of those hurdles. So thank you for doing this. Thank you for being down in Douglas County. I had attended a meeting not long ago at the Oakland Economic Development Committee at Tolley's, Oregon, and I walked in and was very pleased to see Ruth there to give her presentation. So she's covering the state as well as doing the work from our office. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Okay.
Thank
you. Did you have?
Yes, I do.
Actually, I had a question. Fagan.
Oh, thank you. This is exactly what we wanted to have happen.
Good.
And there's just like little nitty gritty things that you can't point to and say, this is the problem, because there's just so many moving parts in state government and interface with, as they interface with the business community. This is what we wanted to do, is just kind of micro-target some of these issues. Mm-hmm. So that's good. But I'm wondering, where are you getting most of your referrals from? How are people finding you?
Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher, it's kind of a mixed bag. I would say that in the very beginning, most of the referrals that, or most of the contacts in my office came through our website. Initially, when we deployed my web page and kind of the associated documents with that, my contact information was lumped with that of the Corporation Division. And during February, the Corporation Division received record numbers of phone calls from businesses that were having difficulty because of the problems with our systems. Because that happened, I saw that as an opportunity. So I, during that time, took something like 1,000 calls that during that month, in addition to being over here and meeting with many of you, and I told every single business what I actually do, as opposed to, you know, just solving their problem with the Corporation Division. And in every case, I tried to do that as well. So there were only a few cases where I had to refer that back to the Corporation Division folks to handle, because it was usually pretty low-level stuff. So a lot of activity was generated by the fact that we had a problem. So turning that into an opportunity was a good thing. The website has been very helpful in terms of just driving traffic. I've done a lot of outreach. I'm over 50 and close to 60 chambers. Countless government and non-government job builders, lots of capital providers, especially non-bank lenders throughout the state, a ton of people like that. And in speaking kind of local Rotary clubs, local chambers of commerce membership meetings, the Economic Development Association in Oakland, I always see an uptick in the kinds of inquiries I'm receiving from that particular area. So they're beginning to happen because I am physically in a community at some point during the week. You know, I was in Coos Bay last week, and I had a couple of cases as a result of that, one of which I was able to close this morning. So I don't have an actual graph for you, though, on that.
Oh,
so.
That's okay. I just wondered, you know, anecdotally, from your experience, where yeah. So that's good to know the website's working.
Yes. And I would add that legislators have been very, very gracious in terms of including information about this office in their newsletters. Several legislators in both chambers have asked me to participate in town halls, and that has been a really, really rewarding way to connect directly with small businesses in a community. So, in fact, I'll be doing a town hall for Senator Mona Sanderson. I think that's the next one I have coming up, and I've done them kind of around the state. So if you haven't done a small business-focused town hall, please consider me a volunteer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Fagan.
Thank you very much. As you remember from during the session, because I was one of the sponsors of what created your office, and there was a lot of skepticism about why don't we just, you know, get rid of this particular regulation instead of having an office. But I think you've pointed out one of the challenges to that is, you know, we only have control over one layer of the regulations. It could be city, county, metro, state, various agencies. Then it's also federal, and perhaps even you'll encounter eventually international things. And so I think that it's important because we only have control over one of those layers. So, but obviously as a small business, it's just like, what do I have to do? They don't, you know, they need someone who can just kind of guide them through, okay, here's the federal regulation, here's the county regulation. Sounds like you're doing that beautifully. So great job, great presentation. Happy to see it working as we intended it to work. And as a kind of a final question, I think I know the answer, but just so I can make sure I know the answer. If somebody does call, you gave the example of Mike's Jerky, and it turns out they're not in compliance, or this woman with the kind of enclosed, is there a safe harbor provision so that it's not like you find out that they're out of compliance and then somebody can come in? There's a safe harbor. Is that just policy, or is that actually like hard firewall?
Chair Doherty, Representative Fagan, that's a really good question. So because I am an appointee of the Secretary of State, I do not have enforcement capabilities over business or over agencies. So neither can I. If I hear about a business that's doing something that's wrong, you know, maybe unethical, not the way I would do it, if I were in business in their industry, I can't report them. I don't do any of that kind of thing. I see myself in this role as being a business booster, not one that's going to tear down businesses. If I were to learn about a crime, I would report it. Absolutely. This, I don't know that they were manufacturing beef jerky after we had a conversation, and so I can't necessarily report a crime, and so I don't do that. In this case, too, I would say because I understood from the initial contact that there was likely an issue where they were not in compliance with state and federal law, too, because the FDA regulates this as well, and the counties regulate it. I did not push to take correct and complete information from this company. I gave them the information that they asked me for, and I left it at that.
Any other questions, comments? A couple of comments. First of all, the report that Ruth was talking about is like the second attachment in the OLIS. We don't have it in paper.
Okay.
But one thing when you guys go through and do read these, notice the quickness of the reports. In other words, the case may be received, for example, the one that we have on OLIS, on January 8th. The preliminary report came in on January 17th. And in this case, and this was the one with the trucking, and she talked about how the final solution came in March. But in February is when the final report was, and that was on a long one. Some of these others are all done within a week. So I appreciate, you know, first, it's a very thorough report, but also doing it in a very timely manner is something I think the business appreciates.
Chair Doherty, not every report is going to be like that. And the reason those were quick is because the agency folks were extremely cooperative and timely in terms of their response to my questions and through the process of the investigation. That is not always the case.
Yeah, but it looks like you make an attempt to get through things through in a, not, I won't say an expedited manner, in a good manner. So, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Ruth, thank you very much. You are definitely all about and all around, and I know that we were going to have an event at the Tiger Chamber that was hopefully postponed. We'll try again, but I appreciate all that you've done.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the only business that we have now, but before you guys leave, a couple of things. I know we have another interim days in December, but I do want to take the opportunity to thank some of the members of this committee that will not be here next session, and Fire Chief / Representative Matthews, Mr. Thompson, who we will miss terribly, Commissioner / Representative Freeman, and maybe Senator / Representative Thatcher. But these are the folks that will not be in the House next year. And the one thing I want to say is that, you know, with all of the problems that we have, and people say, oh, well, you know, Republicans and Democrats don't get along. Well, they do in Oregon. And we work together, and we work together to solve problems for our constituents and for Oregonians. And I think that the people that are leaving our committee are going to be sadly missed and sorely missed because of the cooperative nature that we do work together on issues. And I know that at least some of you will be out there helping other folks. You just don't have to drive as far. So I appreciate your work on the committee. You guys are going to be missed, and I just wanted to thank you for all you've done, not only for the House of Representatives, but also for your constituents. Okay.
You're here.
So with that, anything else? Representative Kinnemer.
And I want to thank you for starting at 9 o'clock and for operating in a rather businesslike fashion and being done before 11.
That's so good. That's what we do. That's
maybe
what we do.
We practice what we preach.
Okay, so with that, we are adjourned.
Maybe we practice what we preach.
Okay, so with that, we are adjourned.